Walkout.
Some people consider the walkout in Uvalde to be una mancha negra and something that it's a hurt, and they don't want to bring it up. But it's algo que sí pasó. Just like this massacre on May 24th. Yeah, it's a black mark, but there are people who, you know, prefer to have the luddy-duddy version of history. Like Dale Evans, like Matthew McConaughey, and non-controversial stories. La vida no es así.
That report by the Texas Tribune reporters Uriel Garcia and Ginesau Hernandez, Juan?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Sewell Chang why you decided to break this story or go back into history at this time in terms of Uvalde, because obviously there were walkouts throughout South Texas in those in those years, in California in 68, the Chicano high school walkouts then. Why you decided that this was important to tell now?
Juan, well, we felt that it was very important to talk about the activism in this community, that the fact that a half century ago, during the Chicano movement, the Mexican-American political movement, there was a surge of activism. And, you know, my question has been, what's happened since then, right? This is an overwhelmingly working class, overwhelmingly Hispanic community. As Amy pointed out earlier, it's become heavily militarized. It's relatively close to the border. And, you know, these are a lot of the families have, you know, folks in law enforcement working in Homeland Security or Border Patrol or even ICE, which is one reason why South Texas has become more politically contested, with Republicans making some substantial gains in the last few years. And so we felt it was important to connect that history of activism to the story of what's going on today, where the power structure, you know, remains pretty overwhelmingly Anglo. And, you know, what happened to that moment of kind of relative hope and relative, you know, political energy a half century ago?
Sewell Chang, we want to thank you so much for being with us, editor-in-chief of the Texas Tribune. We want to talk to you about San Antonio, the 53 migrant deaths. We'll post it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Lewis. Please stay safe.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is due.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, at least seven are dead in the July 4th mass shooting in Chicago. Oregon puts new funds towards supporting teachers, and updated rules are in play for managing Pacific Northwest rivers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 5th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The death toll has reached at least seven in the 4th of July mass shooting at a parade in a Chicago suburb. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
A gunman killed at least six and injured at least 30 in a July 4th shooting in the Chicago suburb of Highland Park. The shooter fired upon an Independence Day parade from a nearby rooftop and then fled. He opened fire around 10:15 a.m. when the parade was about three quarters through. Authorities then searched for him for hours while local residents sheltered in place. After a traffic stop and chase yesterday evening, police detained a man they described as a person of interest. A police officer pulled over 21-year-old Robert E. Cremo III around 5 miles north of the shooting scene. Police had already released the man's photo and warned that he was likely armed and dangerous. Cremo was an aspiring rapper with the stage name Awake the Rapper. He had posted dozens of videos and songs on social media, some violent. Cremo's father ran unsuccessfully for mayor of Highland Park in 2019, calling himself a person for the people. Police offered no other motive for the shooting. The shooting occurred at a spot on the parade route where many residents had staked out prime viewing points earlier in the day. During the shooting, hundreds of parade goers fled. Several of the victims died at the scene, and one died at a hospital. At least 5 people killed at the parade were adults. North Shore University Health Center received 26 patients after the attack, all but one with gunshot wounds. Their ages ranged from 8 to 85, with an estimated 4 or 5 being children. Highland Park Police Commander Chris O'Neill, the incident commander on scene, said the gunman apparently used a high-powered rifle, which was recovered. Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering said she did not know where the gun came from, but that it was legally obtained. President Joe Biden said yesterday he and First Lady Jill Biden were, quote, shocked by the senseless gun violence that has yet again brought grief to an American community on this Independence Day, end quote. Highland Park is a relatively wealthy community of about 30,000 on Chicago's North Shore. Since the start of the year, there have been 15 shootings where 4 or more people have been killed, including the Highland Park one, according to a mass killing database. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The shooting near Chicago leaves 7 dead and dozens injured. Democratic governors huddled to ensure abortion access, and officials say the controversial Remain in Mexico immigration policy will be phased out this week. With more on these stories, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
On a day that we came together to celebrate community and freedom, we're instead mourning the loss, the tragic loss of life, and struggling with the terror that was brought upon us.
At least 6 people were killed in a shooting at a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois. CNN reported the attack in the Chicago suburb also left at least 24 injured. Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering said law enforcement agencies are collaborating on the investigation.
We've had an outpouring of support from federal, state, county, and fellow municipalities of resources and offers of condolences and concern, and we will avail ourselves of everything that they offer to us immediately.
According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been more than 300 mass shootings in America so far this year, including 3 on the 4th of July alone. The attack comes just a few days after President Joe Biden signed into law a bipartisan gun control package, which supporters contend will help prevent future mass shootings. President Biden hosted an Independence Day celebration at the White House, noting the country has faced setbacks, but encouraging Americans to, quote, celebrate the goodness of our nation.
We've been tested before, just as we're being tested today, but we've never failed because we have never walked away from the core beliefs and promises that define this nation.
Facing a tumultuous Supreme Court term, rising inflation, and other issues, foreign and domestic, a new Associated Press poll finds Biden's approval rating down about 16% from last July 4th. The poll includes data from before and after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the aftermath of which is shaping up to be one of the administration's biggest tests. Over the weekend, the president convened a meeting of Democratic governors to discuss steps they're taking to protect abortion access. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham says her state will reject extradition orders from states with abortion bans.
We will not cooperate as a state in any of those efforts or investigations. We will provide coverage and protection for all of our providers and any individual seeking abortion care and abortion services in the state of New Mexico.
According to the Center for Reproductive Rights, most of New Mexico's surrounding states, except Colorado, either have an abortion ban already in place or will likely pass one soon. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says it will take several weeks for the Biden administration to sunset the Remain in Mexico immigration policy, which compelled asylum seekers to remain on the Mexican side of the border while their claims were processed. The Supreme Court issued a ruling last week which affirmed the president's authority to end the Trump-era immigration policy, which was criticized by immigrant and human rights groups. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Jonah Chester. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
As many celebrated the July 4th holiday yesterday, experts are warning that American democracy is in peril. Eric Tegedoff has more.
This July 4th marks nearly 250 years since the United States declared its independence, setting the country on a path to establish its democracy. But some feel the state of U.S. democracy needs close examination. Lindsay Schubiner is with the Portland-based organization Western States Center. She directs its Momentum program, which is focused on countering white nationalism, and says it's clear to many that the future of democracy is in peril.
The country has watched as bigoted and anti-democracy movements have built political power and have been welcomed into mainstream politics, at least by many people, and that has had enormous and devastating repercussions.
As an example, she points to the white nationalist shooting of 10 black people in Buffalo, New York in May, and the January 6th insurrection at the nation's capital in an attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Schubiner says the congressional hearing on January 6th is important because it's holding people accountable for what happened.
It's critical to have elected officials and community leaders speak out clearly and forcefully and repeatedly, both in support of inclusive democracy, but also to clearly reject the bigoted and anti-democracy movements.
Schubiner encourages people to join and organize with local and neighborhood groups.
We really do have the power to protect our democracy if we take action together, and a lot of that can start at the local level.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon is investing in teachers as real concerns about teacher retention and shortages continue. The legislature passed a bill that creates incentives for teachers to stay in their jobs and more support for them to do so. KBOO's Josh Salem has the story.
Oregon school districts are trying to ensure they have adequate teachers and staffing next year. Legislation passed in the 2022 session will help. House Bill 4030 allocate $78 million in grants to pay for recruitment and retention efforts, including bonuses, and to reimburse substitute teachers and instructional assistants for training costs. The Oregon Department of Education required school district grant use to fall under several broad parameters, which include diversifying workforce, reducing burnout, and training. The legislation includes $22 million for other educational programs, including a workforce data system. The Oregon Department of Education has received 266 applications for the grant funding. As of June 28th, 222 were approved, with 46 requiring additional clarifications. The McMinnville District plans to use its grant monies, more than $850,000 as well as other funding sources, to offer staff retention bonuses and aid in employee wellness. Klamath County School District will use its nearly $1 million to hire 4 part-time mentors for new teachers, and as an investment in professional development for certified and classified staff. Beaverton will apply at least some of its $5 million in funds towards paid training for substitute teachers and educational assistants, ensuring the classrooms will be led by someone adequately trained. The district is also using some of its funds on retention bonuses. Officials say the grant funds provided by House Bill 4030 are not a long-term solution. For example, there simply are not sufficient people in the field of education right now, especially specialty areas. To help, more than 21 school districts and community colleges have banded together to form the Mid-Willamette Education Consortium. McMinnville School District Human Resources Director Stephanie Frost said creative thinking, non-traditional programs, and more university recruitment are tools groups can use to help solve school staffing issues. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon's management plan for estuaries, the marine wetlands along the state's coastline, is nearly 4 decades old. Now, the state plans to make an update, starting with the Yaquina River estuary. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Oregon's estuaries, the wetlands where the ocean meets rivers and streams, are rich habitat for wildlife, and they even store carbon from the atmosphere to help fight climate change. But the state's plans to manage them are now decades old. That's why Oregon is setting out to update them. The Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development is piloting this revision project with the Yaquina River Estuary Management Plan. Katie Ryan heads the Wetlands Conservancy, which is part of the update project on the Yaquina River.
These estuary management plans are outdated, and they just don't take into account the current challenges that land managers have in these estuaries.
Oregon's estuary plans were developed in the 1980s. However, some vital elements were left out of the original process, including the involvement of tribal nations. This time around, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians is part of the steering committee and advisory group on the first revision of the Yaquina River Plan. Ryan says estuaries are an important part of Oregon's goal to reduce carbon in the atmosphere.
Our coastal wetlands store carbon and actually in a lot of ways hold more carbon than our forests do. We just have quite a few less tidal wetlands than we do forests. So they help with climate change by helping store carbon.
Ryan notes estuaries also are rich and crucial habitats for shorebirds, as well as juvenile salmon. She says that's important for the economy.
In terms of this robust fishing industry that happens on the Oregon coast, our estuaries are huge for helping to support those economies. So I think just looking at the economies that rely on our estuaries, we want to make sure that the plans, you know, take their business into account.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Congress is considering a measure that would protect culturally and economically important rivers on the Olympic Peninsula. KBOO's Ashley Mackey has more.
June was National Rivers Month, and a diverse host of supporters are calling for greater protections of the Olympic Peninsula's rivers and landscapes. The Wild Olympics Wilderness and Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in Congress would protect more than 126,000 acres as wilderness and designate 19 rivers and their tributaries as wild and scenic. The legislation has received support from local elected officials, tribes, businesses, and conservation groups. Ashley Nicole Lewis owns Bad Ash Fishing on the Olympic Peninsula and is a member of the Quinault Nation.
Protecting these forests, protecting these watersheds are super important culturally because salmon and steelhead fishing really is the bedrock of my culture as an Indigenous woman and also as somebody who works in the ecotourism field.
She says these are some of the most unique and productive salmon and steelhead waterways in the country. Nicole Lewis says safeguarding these landscapes now, while they are still in good condition, is crucial. She notes that the measure will protect fishing, boating, and hunting without closing down access to any of these opportunities.
It protects the Olympic Peninsula's ancient forests, free-flowing rivers, and salmon streams for the future, but it also permanently protects some of the last healthy upstream salmon and steelhead habitats left on the peninsula.
Nicole Lewis says the bill has benefits for the region's endangered orcas as well, which need the salmon from the peninsula's rivers to survive. She says everyone has a reason to care about this.
From the point in which a salmon swims up the river, dies, brings nutrients from the ocean into the forest, creates healthy forests, which creates cleaner air, every point of this is important and connected to anything that we care about in the Northwest.
For KBOO News and the Washington News Service, I'm Ashley Mackey.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will have a 30% chance of rain and a high of 74. Today in history, in 1962, Algerian independence is proclaimed after an 8-year war with France. The quote of the day is from American tennis player Arthur Ashe, who today in 1975 became the first black man to win the Wimbledon singles title. He said, quote, "Start where you are, use what you have, do what you can." A bill in the California legislature would ensure that Native groups have input in renaming a college of law that's named after a man who committed atrocities against Native people. and indigenous communities gathered to raise their voices on the topic of abortion. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill to ensure Native Americans are included in the renaming of the University of California Hastings College of Law is advancing in the California legislature. It passed the Senate Education Committee last week. The college is named for a land speculator who built his fortune committing atrocities against Northern California tribes. The bill, introduced by Native American Assemblymember James Ramos, strikes the name Hastings from the school and creates a process for renaming. Ramos says having Native people rename the college is restorative justice for the Round Valley Indian tribes whose ancestors were killed by Serenus Hastings. The California legislature named the school in state statute in the 1800s, and legislative action is required to rename the campus. In 2021, the college board approved changing the school's name and has been in discussion with tribes. The bill passed the education committee with a 6-0 bipartisan vote and now heads to the Senate Appropriations Committee. Members of the Native community in Lawrence, Kansas gathered last week to amplify their voices on the topic of abortion. The panel, titled Indigenous Voices and Abortion Justice, explored the historical context of abortion bans and the possible impacts to the Native community with the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision overturning Roe versus Wade. Democratic member of the Kansas House of Representatives, Christina Haswood, was among panelists expressing frustration. She says Native women already lack access to abortion health care, pointing to a provision barring the use of federal funds to pay for abortion.
With the Hyde Amendment too, we've always never had abortion care as accessible as maybe some other folks. It's really concerning for the Native population because we really depend on Indian health services, and especially when we're getting out of Kansas into rural areas as well, hour or 2 hours for health care services. And we have the highest rates of mortality and morbidity for maternal and pregnancy-related complications.
Haswood says adding to the recent high court ruling is an upcoming vote on abortion policy in Kansas. During the August primary, voters will decide whether to amend the state constitution to remove the right to abortion. Haswood says she's frustrated as a politician and a Native woman, seeing Indigenous voices not really being heard at the state and national level.
You know, just thinking about my own health, and if it were to come to that, would I die giving birth? It's kind of a scary thought that I just realized now, just how valuable the choice was and how the choice for me growing up and being in the position I was has always been so empowering. I don't think I would have gone this far in my career, an academic career, with the comfort of knowing that I always had a choice.
Haswood says she's working with her team to organize this summer ahead of the August 2nd primary. Meanwhile, last week's panel discussion included members of the Indigenous Community Center, which plans to host a second event to further the discussion on abortion from Indigenous perspectives. The U.S. Department of Justice has opened the application period for federally recognized tribes to take part in the Tribal Access Program for National Crime Information. It allows tribes to access and exchange data with National Crime Information databases. Justice Department officials say it's a tool for tribal police, governments, and courts to investigate crimes, keep communities safe, and hold offenders accountable. The program provides training, software, workstations to process fingerprints, take mugshots, and submit information to the FBI. There are currently more than 100 tribes participating in the program. This round of applications opened July 1st and closes at the end of August. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Advocates of open primaries and ranked choice voting in Nevada are celebrating since their state Supreme Court rejected a legal challenge to getting their changes on the ballot. KBOO's Maor Shapiro has more on the story.
A proposal to change the way Nevada votes is one step closer to getting on the November ballot after the state Supreme Court rejected a legal challenge. The Better Voting Nevada campaign wants to chuck the closed partisan primaries where you can only vote for your registered party and move to an open primary. Sandra Cosgrove is a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada. She would like to change the state constitution to expand the number of candidates who move to the general election, to give more independent candidates a shot.
We want to have more options, so we don't want just two people moving forward from the primary to the general election. We want five, because oftentimes when you look at the people who move forward, it's just the people with the most money.
The proposal would also institute ranked choice voting in the general election. People would rank the candidates in order of preference, and if no one gets 51%, the lowest vote getter falls off. And the second choice of that person's voters gets added to the total, and so on, until someone has a majority. This ballot measure is opposed by many of the state's top Democrats and by some community organizers because they say it would be too confusing for voters. Cosgrove argues that the open primary system would give candidates incentive to appeal to the widest range of voters instead of producing far right or far left candidates who appeal to the extremes of their base.
And so we're hoping that candidates will do the more moderate platform in the primary and then just continue with that moderate platform as they move forward.
The campaign just turned in the last batch of signatures last week. This proposal would amend the state constitution, so it would have to be approved by voters in two successive elections. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Maor Shapiro.
A New York Times article recently exposed the contract bidding process in China for surveillance contracts, which have been particularly repressive to the Uyghur population. These intrusive technologies, though, are not limited to just China. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. In a recent commentary, I discussed the visit to China of the UN's chief human rights official on what proved to be a seriously misguided and rather naive attempt to improve the conditions of the Uyghur population in Xinjiang. An important element in that mass internment of innocent civilians is China's ubiquitous surveillance system, which has facilitated the roundup of Chinese Muslims. That system is not confined to the Uyghurs. It is a many-layered, nationwide network designed to collect personal data for police and security units on every Chinese citizen whose behavior or personal characteristics might be troublesome to the authorities. In a word, no one is above suspicion. Now, a New York Times investigative group has acquired over 100,000 Chinese government bidding documents. They call for companies to bid on the contracts to provide surveillance technology and include all kinds of other important information. The documents make perfectly clear why China is often called the surveillance state. Its facial recognition technology, DNA analysis, and other tools that intrude into people's identity go far beyond anything other countries use or George Orwell imagined. We already knew some dimensions of the Chinese surveillance system before the Times report. For instance, various sources told of Chinese hackers embedding malware in smartphones to track Uyghurs' movements and conversations, even when they left China. China's Ministry of Public Security announced plans to obtain the DNA via blood samples of tens of millions of male adults and children, with Xinjiang and Tibet the starting point for creating a database to cover virtually the entire population. Cameras with facial recognition capability are literally everywhere. Western publications on genetics abetted Chinese efforts to identify Uyghurs as well as Tibetans by carrying many articles that had a co-author from the Chinese police, the military, or the judiciary, according to a Belgian geneticist. The Times report based on contract bidding adds a good deal to the picture. Facial recognition cameras are now installed in private as well as public places. They're capable of collecting voice and iris prints and race and gender information for inclusion in an ever-expanding database. Phone tracking not only gives a person's location, but also usernames and certain activities, such as social connections and personal habits. As the UN's recent mission found out, it's impossible to conduct an impartial, on-the-spot investigation in Xinjiang or other places. One action the international community can take is to name and shame the perpetrators of genocide in Xinjiang and Beijing. Governments can also intercede with technology firms that enable the Chinese to collect and upgrade their surveillance. Banning the import of products of forced labor, as the U.S. has now done with all Xinjiang-based exports, is another step. To date, however, these steps have had limited success, demonstrating anew the difficulties in defending human rights when the means of repression are a matter of global commerce. Think that the Chinese surveillance state is of no consequence for us? Intrusive technologies embedded in social media are already part of our daily lives. Closed-circuit cameras track ordinary citizens and criminals alike. Now, consider how the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision might deepen the surveillance state here. If, for example, women were to cross state lines in violation of local law, to obtain an abortion or pills to induce abortion, will they be subject to official tracking for prosecution? Might every pregnant woman in a red state be forced to install a tracking device on her phone? Might anti-abortion states be able to access apps some women use to track their menstrual cycles, nabbing those women believed to be in the early stages of pregnancy? I'm inclined to say that in states where abortion is outlawed, and even worse if the Supreme Court makes abortions illegal nationwide, the tools of a police state will be endorsed as necessary for full implementation of the law, just as in China. The Chinese already use apps and cell phones to monitor and quarantine citizens who show signs of COVID. As Xi Jinping said, big data should be used as an engine to power the innovative development of public security work. You can bet that some American politicians believe the same and have particular targets in mind. For starters, racial minorities, human rights protesters, and investigative journalists. In China, ordinary people have no recourse if the surveillance system catches them. The days of private lawyers occasionally able to defend people in court are numbered. The police are all powerful. Few safeguards of privacy exist. Xi Jinping has provided a model of high-tech authoritarianism that can exist side by side with consistent economic growth. We should beware. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 5th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, Ashley Mackey, and Maor Shapiro. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Jonah Chester, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.